Hello, and welcome to SoberCast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting SoberCast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
I'm John. Oh, go you shit. I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, there goes the anonymity thing. I'm not sorry. I just swore. I'm an alcoholic. I still swear. I haven't outgrown it yet. I probably won't. How's that for an opening line? Because I think Alcoholics Anonymous is about being true to myself. It's not about becoming good. It's about getting sober. And it's about being of service to people and giving back what people freely gave you. And if I walked into a room where no one was swearing, I would have thought it was at a church group and I would have gotten the fuck out of there. That's me. That doesn't mean I don't absolutely respect God, everybody's higher power, the whole thing. It's just I love alcoholics, and I want to be a part of somebody else getting sober, and I want them to feel comfortable, and I'm an alcoholic, and I want to feel comfortable, and I trust people talking the way they talk, not trying to be something else. Look, I didn't plan that little, was Taco taking the picture. I was born in San Francisco, right in the middle of the Haight-Ashbury. It was an accident that I grew up there. Like, my mother didn't intend on being a hippie in the early 60s. It's all part of my story, because, like, the first drugs and alcohol I did, my babysitter started smoking pot with us when I was 8 years old. I grew up then in Marin County, across the bridge from San Francisco, in the height of the hippie stuff, and nobody really thought about saying no to anything. I still don't really think about saying no to anything. I actually still don't want to say no to anything. By the time I was 11 or 12 years old, I was standing in front of liquor stores, sometimes for 3 hours at a time, trying to get older people to buy me bottles of booze. Now, that's at 12 years old. At 11 years old, my mother had to mark all her liquor bottles, you know, with a pen. A lot of good that did, you know, just add water. And at 12 or 13, I drove the car through the house drunk. I got taken home by the police for drinking at Boy Scouts. It just started young for me. Because I guess where I grew up and because of the atmosphere, I basically drank almost every day until the day I got sober. I got sober pretty young. I was 24 and a half, something like that. And by the time I got sober, I had ulcers. I had hepatitis. I was yellow. Like, the hepatitis was really moving. But I didn't believe that I was yellow. I mean, this is the classic AA thing for me. Like, even when I got sober, everybody said, "You look a little, your color seems funny." And I'd look in the mirror and I couldn't see the yellow, so I thought they were full of shit. You know, like, if you're yellow, you don't really notice the yellow. And, I'm just gonna jump around. Before I got sober, there were all sorts of little hints that I had a problem. The ulcers happened a couple of years before I stopped drinking. The doctor said, "You better stop drinking." I, like a good alcoholic, said, "I'll stop mixing things with the alcohol. So I won't drink orange juice with vodka anymore. I'll just drink vodka." Then I tried cutting out food. All spicy food went. Milk, baked potatoes, they were good. I thought they were good, because you know, they allowed me to continue drinking. I thought the doctor was kind of full of shit, and I could just, you know, anything to avoid the reality of what alcohol was doing to me. I just didn't think alcohol was my problem. I haven't met many alcoholics who really believe alcohol is their problem. It's always something else. Always. And I guess I'm sober a while now, and I still always believe my problem is something else. I don't know if that's ever going to go away. In a weird way, I kind of hope it doesn't. Shit, I'm going to jump all over the place. You know what I hate in AA at times? I hate when people get up there and they talk about their resentments or their fears or whatever, but they say, I've got these resentments, but they don't say what they are. Okay? And then they say, I've got these fears, but they don't say what the fears are. And I kind of go, well, that's nice. You know, like, that's cool that you've labeled something, but it's sort of like watching CNN or something. It's like, you know, like the newscaster is going to ask the other newscaster about something that no one knows about, and we're all going to get informed. It's kind of a, and I resent the shit out of the newscasters too. So I guess I'm saying I resent that in AA, when we talk like that. I get resentments and fears still at 17, almost 18 years sober. I get lots of them. In fact, I think the world generates them at a really fast rate now. You put me on, I regrettably am a musician. It's not regrettable I'm a musician. It's regrettable that I work with a computer to make music. And I have to call technology companies and get technical support. And when I get put on that endless queue where no one's there, where my warranty says that I have no warranty, where it's just an endless circle of double talk, and I'm made to look like a jerk because I complain about it, I get a resentment. You know, it's just 1 + 1 = 2. And on that resentment, I can pray about it, but I can also talk about it. Oh, I mean, I'm going to say one thing weird. This is going to be a weird pitch. You know, it's not going to be normal. I'm not normal, by the way. I'm fucking proud of that. I'm sober. I'm sober. That's it. That's it. Nothing more. I'm sober. You may not want my level of serenity. You probably wouldn't want big parts of my career. You probably wouldn't want my love life. But I'm sober. And, God, I'm really going to jump. Here's the thing. I've seen plenty of people go out and drink in the time I've been here who look like everything was going well. In fact, most of them aren't in the program anymore. The ones who've complained, who've moaned, who've had resentments, and who've had the balls to not just say, I've got a resentment, but to say, I fucking hate the TV newscaster. There's some trivial thing like that. Or, you know, for me, I hate SUVs. You know, when I'm behind big gas-guzzling cars, I resent the hell out of it. The people who get specific and say what the hell they resent and are willing to not look AA good in public, for some weird reason, they stick around. You can hear them complaining 17 years later. You know, like, you know, it's like it just keeps ticking. You know, like, let's see. Okay, well, I'll jump. I love sponsors in AA. I've had. Like, I'm a musician, that's the main thing I do. None of my sponsors have been musicians. None of them have been artists. When I first got sober, I looked for the perfect artist musician to be my sponsor. I found a guy. He wrote the steps on a napkin. I called him. The phone was disconnected. I never saw him again. That was the guy I chose as the perfect sponsor. I'll go on the sponsor thing for a little while here. I didn't share at all. I mean, I can stand up in front of a pretty big crowd and not be too nervous. But my first 6 months in AA, I didn't share at all. The first share I had was at a round robin where I didn't know it was a round robin or I wouldn't have gone. And when it got to me, I said, my name is John, I'm an alcoholic, and I pass. And that was my first share, was I pass, you know? But it got me involved, just saying I pass, you know? And it's 6 months sober with the hepatitis blooming and getting more and more yellow. When I went to this big, big, big L.A. meeting, I walked into this room, and I'm coming up the stairs, and the guy, you know, gave me that sympathetic AA look, you know, oh, you must be new, you know, with his hand out. And I'd been there 6 months. I was sober, but I looked like shit, you know. And I looked like I was very new. And I just go, you know, I need a sponsor, like, you know. And I mean, anybody who's been in Amsterdam, like, I lived here for a while, and I love this country very much. It's a special place. And it was special for me in many ways. They've probably heard this vignette. But I say, I need a sponsor to this guy. And he goes, well, go in and ask for one at the meeting. It's a huge fucking meeting. You know, not as big as this, but a couple. It was big. And I, okay, sure. And I went and sat down, as I did, kind of far in the back. He sat behind me. And then, you know, he taps and he goes, you know, raise your hand. You know, tell me you need a sponsor. And so I do this, you know, little thing like this. And he had sat behind me, and he pointed to the speaker. So I get up there, and I go to the front, and I'm pouring sweat and really nervous. And I go, you know, I need a sponsor. And I'm screwed. And I went back, and I sat down, and this guy tapped me again. He said, I'll be your sponsor. Actually, I'm going to shift gears for 1 second because this is important to me. I don't know, with the new book, maybe it's on a different page, but is it? Hang on a second. It's in A Vision for You. Okay. All right, here it is. It's... All this time, our friend of the hotel lobby incident remained in that town. He was there 3 months. He now returned home, leaving behind his first acquaintance, the lawyer and the devil-may-care chap. These men had found something brand new in life. Though they knew they must help other alcoholics if they would remain sober, that motive became secondary. It was transcended by the happiness they found in giving themselves for others. They shared their homes, their slender resources, and gladly devoted their spare hours to fellow sufferers. Actually, I'll just repeat that fucking line. They shared their homes, their slender resources, and gladly devoted their spare hours to fellow sufferers. They were willing, by day or night, to place a new man in the hospital and visit him afterward. They grew in numbers. They experienced a few distressing failures, but in those cases, they made an effort to bring the man's family into a spiritual way of living, thus relieving much worry and suffering. A year and 6 months later, these three had succeeded with seven more. Seeing much of each other, scarce an evening pass at someone's home did not shelter a little gathering of men and women, happy in their release. And this is the thing, and constantly thinking how they might present their discovery to some newcomer. And what that man did with me that night was he was fucking creative. You know, he got me to ask for the sponsor, but he was willing to do it right from the start. He was creative. I actually followed the suggestion, even though I didn't want to. I sat back. He said he'd be my sponsor. Sometimes in AA these days, I hear people say, well, you know, he'll get it when he's ready, blah, 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 blah. And I think to myself, no, he's got a better chance of getting it when I'm ready to be creative about figuring out a way of helping him get it. That's what AA is all about, in my opinion. It's about us in AA being creative with the people who are having a tough time and figuring out a way of helping them get it if we can. Well, fuck, we're going to fail, you know, because alcoholics are resistant to change. Some. But if we put some juice into it, things happen, you know, like, and it's not 1 + 1 = 2. It's 1 + 3 = 7. It's bizarre. It's like it's not the Brady Bunch. It's like, it's, it's not Oprah Winfrey. It's not CNN. It's weird. It's not logical. It's about caring for somebody else, and in doing that, magic happens to you for doing it. Magic, like insane good magic, not economic rationalism business magic, where, you know, you work a bit harder and you put in a couple extra hours and you get a nicer fucking house. Who cares? Like, you know, it seems like everybody doing that ends up depressed. You know, there's something not depressing about participating in helping be creative, in helping another alcoholic stop drinking. And it's not always simple. It's, you know, we're convoluted people. And we've got, you know, like, I think alcoholics have the biggest bullshit meters on earth. We smell a lie from 800 miles away. And so if I'm insincerely going up to some newcomer and going and rattling off the steps in some rote fashion, it may all be the right words, but the feeling is like a bad old teacher. You know, it's not genuine. It's not built for that character. I mean, I'll tell you some things that, one guy I was sponsoring, and I'm not saying I do, I'm different with each person I work with. Like, my sponsors were all different with me. Except for one. I had the same routine with everybody, and he was real successful, so there's no right way of doing it. But, one guy I sponsored, this was years ago, we had a meeting in his little theater. This was in Venice, in LA, and, he started drinking, and I was just, and it was getting ugly, and I was just like, Scott, come on, you know, come back. And he's like, no, I'm not going. And I said, I came in to visit him, and I went into his little office. I said, why don't you come on? And I go, well, how's this? I'll start knocking the books off the shelves until you say you're going to come along with me. Now, this is not normal good AA at all, you know. Like, this is... Okay, after a few books fell off the shelf, because Scott was highly organized. And those books mattered, you know, like, even though he's drunk, the books on the shelf were very important to him. And I intuitively knew something that would baffle me, I guess. Anyway, he went to the meeting that night, and there was this guy, Father Terry, speaking, and he took to him like a duck in water, and he became his sponsor, and he's been sober ever since. And that was that weird story. Like how I got into AA. My God, if you had to do this right, what a joke, okay? Like, how I got here is, there was a prostitute who fell in love with her client, who was a longtime sober AA guy, and she came to AA because she fell in love with her customer, the AA guy. Then she realized she was an alcoholic when she came to the meetings. She was the best friend of the woman who got me in the program, who was a stripper. You get where I'm going here. The stripper realized she was an alcoholic via the woman who had followed her prostitute customer, who was an AA guy. And Julia waited a year watching the stripper, watching me destroy myself, because we worked at this punk club together. And she worked, you know, she was out there. She was great. And she remained out there sober, which was a beacon of light to me. I didn't, you know, I'm not into this normal world stuff. I hate it. She waited a year, watched me destroy myself, and said, hey, do you really think you're dying? I said, oh, I feel that way. Yeah, it's not, it's ugly, you know. And she said, well, you might want to check out an AA meeting. But you see, like, it wasn't right. You know, the prostitute went to the AA meeting for the wrong reason. You know, like, God damn, I don't want to wait for alcoholics to have the right reason to get sober, and I don't want to wait till they nicely ask for help. But I mean, imagine how our program came to be is somebody went to a hotel lobby, called priests and ministers or whatever, and said, are there any people who need help? And he went and offered it. He didn't wait for somebody to come and ask him for it in the proper terms and say, I'm ready now to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't exist. This guy went out and offered, you know, and I think possibly because we're in a weird time period where business runs all our ethics, There's another resentment. Mm-hmm. And that's how I can make it not an outside issue. It's a resentment. I'll say it again. I resent the shit out of the fact that business now runs our morality. I resent it. I don't know how to come to terms with it other than to turn it over to my higher power and to be true to myself and share it here in front of you and be a part of the group conscience and part of the world conscience. AA hasn't stopped me. AA has no opinion on outside issues. I've got plenty of them. You know? And I don't need to be... Oh, here, I'll shift in another direction. Judgment. I love judgment. Judgment, to me these days, has a real bad time of it. Like, everybody's saying I shouldn't judge. I do nothing but. All day long. Non-stop. And I was sitting in the meeting last night and somebody made a totally important distinction. That it's wrong to condemn. But my God, if we didn't judge, how the hell could we help somebody? Like, you got to make a judgment all day long about every little thing that goes on. Good, bad, you know, like, I make a judgment. I'm not doing well today. I need to work a step or I make a judgment of myself. You know, to get rid of judgment means to, in my opinion, again, this is all my opinion, which you won't stay sober by it. You'll have your own, you know. But I think, you know, somehow we've demonized judgment. Like, we've got to get rid of it, become a good, passive, spiritual CNN newscaster and smile and be plastic and be insincere and it's not the real thing. Anyway, I judge all the time and I want to keep judging. I don't want to condemn anyone or anything. I'll go somewhere else. Say, I've never met an alcoholic or an addict who isn't doing the best they can do. Ever. Ever. You know, I sometimes have to sit in meetings and hear other people, you know, blather on about, oh, well, if you really work the traditions this way or that. It's like, I love the traditions. I love the fact that we're still here. We don't kill each other, that the meetings keep growing. You know, I love all that. But the first thing that keeps another alcoholic sober is a hand. It's a hand, a pair of ears, a pair of eyes, and not some tape-recorded message saying, hi, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll give you an SMS on my cell phone and that'll help keep you sober or that'll do the trick. It's just a bit more than that. It's genuine care. And okay, so go back to the sponsor thing. Okay, so I had that sponsor for a while and then I got another guy because that guy, I actually did believe in a higher power. That guy didn't. And when I got to step three, he said, you may want to get somebody who does believe in a higher power. He was great. To this day, I absolutely believe in the spirituality of atheists. I think they've got, you know, this man, and he's still sober, and he's a great man, and he helps a lot of people. But on the third step, he was cool, and he said, look for somebody who, you know. So then I went on a hunt, and the prostitute, or Julia, my stripper friend who got me in the program, as I was now looking for the perfect sponsor again and had no good instincts on this, hey, can you give me a clock so I don't go over time? Or, you know. So I said, I was getting worse and worse and worse. So I said to this woman, who I thought was kind of a radical, I said, can you help me? I'll surrender. You choose my sponsor. I'll go along with who you choose. And who does she choose? You know, like she chooses this guy who carries his big book marked in every 20 colors. I figured he slept with it. You know, like he pounded the thing. He had a smile from here to here. And, you know, my judgmental mind, condemning at that time, said, you know, he's a zealot. I don't want what he has. You know, even though I liked him, even though he was happy, I didn't, you know, the big book, all that wasn't attracted to me. But that's who she chose. And I said I'd go along with who she suggested. And I was pissed. And anyway, I chose this guy and he turned out to be magic because he was great. He did kind of stick to the same thing with most people he worked with. It always went like this. I'd call up, he'd go, John, so good to hear from you. Every time, like, great to hear from you. And he sponsored so many guys, he still does, just tons, you know, he's an amazing man. And I always wondered how this guy could sponsor like 100 guys, you know, and survive, you know, like, but I, years later, I realized how he did it, because it was always the same. John, how are you? I'm great. It's great to hear from you. And he goes, what, always, not a word about him right off the bat. You go, what's going on? And that, like, if you want to get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you want to sponsor people quickly, all you have to do is go up to newcomers on a regular basis and say the three magic words. It's like winding up it's automation. You know, how are you? You know, like, and we go, you know, like, and anyway, so he'd go, what's going on? And I'd go, boom, like that, you know, because it was always insane. And he'd listen for about 5 minutes, and then he'd refer me to something in the big book, and he'd tell me to do something. Now, you can sponsor 200 people in AA. If you tell them to call them back, now call me back after you do this. Right? You know, you can just... I could sponsor almost the entire room. Because you know how long it takes for the average alcoholic to follow a suggestion? If you're really desperate, 1 out of 10 times, you'll follow it quickly, you know? But you'll do it over time. You know, I'm going to keep jumping all over the place. I remember it was actually here in a Dutch AA meeting. I had done my 6-4-step, and I was really proud of this thing. I had done it really thoroughly this time. And I've been fearless and thorough and da-da-da. And I remember I was at the meeting at the Jakobovichstraat, and I shared... I did my 4-step really fast this time. It only took me about 5.5 months. I was really proud of it. I'd done it really thorough. And afterwards, I got home and I thought about what I had said. And I thought, I just said it took me 5.5 months. And I added up how many hours I spent on my 4-step, right? I spent about 5.5 hours on my 4-step. But I had just shared how it, I'd done a really thorough 4-step, and it took me 5.5 months. It took me 5 months and whatever, 179 days of procrastination, 5 hours and a half of actually doing it, and I call that 5.5 months. And that's, to me, that's like most alcoholics I know. I'm, you know, especially when you hear I'm really doing my steps hard right now. You know, like, you know, how many people get through all 12 steps in their first year? Not many. You know, I didn't. I had taste of it. I love AA, and I love people who appear to be the underdogs in AA. I fucking love them. I love the people that everybody else in the program thinks aren't going to make it. Because I was one. I was the yellow guy who was a jerk, who I told everybody in AA I hate them. I didn't share, didn't follow directions for a while, but over time I ended up following direction and doing all that stuff. But, you know, I remember the girl who got sober at the same time as me. She was a little sobriety star and smile all the time. And everybody said, isn't she doing wonderful, blah, blah, blah. And 2 years later, she got drunk. I'm still here. You know, like, you know, there's, and, you know, so I have a lot of time for people who moan, complain, you know, they're difficult. They don't want to work the steps. They do want to work the steps, but they're miserable. I think they're great. I think they're the lifeblood of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're an old timer and you're moaning about them, I think you're a jerk. It's, you know, that's just, you know, and you can get a resentment on me. Hi. if you're an old timer and you're getting resentment about younger people or whatever who aren't doing it good enough, get involved, get creative, and teach them how to do it. If you've got the resentment, you know, bring a little life force to it and see where it can go. And I'll keep going. So now I have the big book guy who is completely my opposite. He looks like Jerry Garcia. He's Jewish. I'm a punk rocker at this time. We get to my 3rd step. He says, meet me at McDonald's on a busy street in L.A., a really busy street. I met him at McDonald's. He says, we do page 61, 62. I have to read it, sign it. after A, B, and C, if I agree that I'm really this pathetic. And then he says, okay, well, let's do the third step prayer. You know, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me, etc. Let's go do it on the sidewalk, on the front of the busy street, in front of McDonald's, holding his hand, on our knees. Like, it was really creative. And it was smart, because I still am an egotistical jerk. You can hear it. Like, you know, I'm not hiding it. I can tell that story now. It did something. I remember it, whether it was a ritual, I don't know. But like when I did my four step, he took me to a graveyard. You know, we burned it. But I'm so grateful to this man. You know, he had little rituals and they worked, or they worked in my mind. They were big deals. I've been in Prague the last few months. There was a young guy. He had been slipping. He had just come back to the program after being put in the Czech mental institution. He only spoke English. No one there spoke English. He's in a mental institution. He had actually stopped drinking, but he went into some sort of alcoholic nuttiness after 2 or 3 days of not drinking and not sleeping. Anyway, he got himself naked in the middle of Wenceslas Square, which is like Dam Square here, and the Czech police locked him up. And so he got out, and I'm working with this guy, and I like him very much, and he's nuts in a good way, and in a very sane way. I'll go into that in a minute. I'm kind of co-sponsoring with this guy, Vlad, and we're having a blast. We're having fun, you know, and we got to step three, and I told Vlad that little story, and I said, Vlad, you come up with a place where we could go do his third step. So he picked Wenceslas Square, and he picked the place where the guy got naked in the middle of the square to go and here I am, whatever, 16 years after I did it the last time, and I'm just as embarrassed, just as nervous, except I'm on the other end, you know, like, it's still all there, like that thing of like, I'm worried that they're going to think I'm a missionary on a mission, you know, like, and I'm converting, and, you know, like, who's they? You know, who is they? You know, like, it's like, you know, who is they? That's a cool thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is I'm 42 now, I realize there is no they. You know, fear of people will leave us. There is no they. I'm it. I'm the they. I'm the they that they were talking about. I'm it. I get afraid of myself. You know, I love that man. I worked with him for 5 years. I'll keep going on the sponsoring thing. I don't believe that I can give back anything to the guys who sponsored me. They've never once called me and asked for my advice. They just haven't. And there's current wisdom going around, the mirror theory and all that crap, in my opinion, that says, well, if you helped me, I helped you, blah, 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 blah. Not true. It's just, in my opinion, not true. I mean, it's nice. I know last week when I did that third step, I absolutely needed to be focused on the third step myself to say those words, and that was helpful to me. But I wasn't coming to this guy to get his advice. I go to other guys. The way the help works and the way it is all equal is I had this group of guys who gave to me their free time, I was nuts. You had to talk to me for many hours for me to go along with anything. I'm still that way now, right? They gave all this free time, and the way it becomes equal is that I give it to someone else, completely different, not them. They don't get it from me. They got it from someone else, and now they give it away for however long they stick around. It's not equal on that level, and that's a nice. How do you say it? It's totally equal. You know, you get given something and you give it away, but it's not usually to the same person. It's to somebody completely, somebody new and anonymous who you don't, who you judge. Who you first judge and then you help, regardless of what your judgment is, because you don't condemn them and you don't take on economic rationalist mode of thinking that says somebody isn't worth it because, you know, some people are expendable. Like, no one's expendable. What I love about Holland is when I came here, in general, it was the first place I ever lived where, in general, people weren't expendable. Where there wasn't a necessary number of homeless people so that we could have a good economy. You know? And regrettably, that business way of looking at things creeps into everything these days. I'll shift again. I still work with a few people in Amsterdam, and it's been fucking great to be here and see them. Somebody called me up that, you know, I've worked with for a while and said, you know, sometimes I have some difficulty with some of my sponsees. They call up and they complain and da-da-da-da-da. And I go, what are they complaining about? And they're complaining that they don't have enough time, they're really busy, da-da-da-da-da. And I tell them to work the steps, but, you know, they want to complain. I said, maybe the first thing you got to do is go, yup, yup, yes. 100%. I know exactly what you're saying. It's happening to me too. And then work the steps. Like, first acknowledge that if you're a normal human being these days and you're in this insane rat race that says you got to commute your half hour an hour, go work 40 plus hours, you know, do your dry cleaning, you go to the gym, hit your 3 or 4 AA meetings, watch CNN 10% of the time, and then you aren't very serene, that there's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you. You're 100% healthy. You don't need anything. If you feel uncomfortable and you're doing all that, you should feel uncomfortable. It's a system designed to make you not feel good. You know, like, we're human beings. We're not, like, my new sponsor, not new, I've had him now 6 or 7 years. My sponsor says that we're not human doings. We're human beings. He says, be. Don't do. He doesn't say don't do, period, but he just says, it's not about being a human doing. If you're a human doing all the time, you're just built for problems. The more you do, the more problems you're going to have. You know? And I question the result of being a human doing. You know? I just don't think the results are all that great. Whereas when I'm a human being, just being part of the time, just flat out being right here, like what this old guy says, and I love this man, he's, you know, I love every one of them, you know, and he's 43 years sober, he's a pretty interesting old guy, he's an Australian sheep shearer, he was also they call him Sailor Bob, he's a bit of a character, you know, he says in the book, it says, God may find him now, right, and he says, if I'm in the past, or if I'm in the future, I owe my higher power an amends. He says 9, 10, and 11 to him is that if I'm in the past, or if I'm in the future, I'm not where the book says the higher power is, which is now. So, and he says, and it's not about guilt, he says the amends is recognized that I'm in the past or the future, and I can only recognize that now. So then I'm with my higher power. And I believe in that, and I believe in his serenity, you know, like that. It's a fantastic example. It may just be that he's a bit old, you know, and calmer. But he, you know, there's a powerful serenity that comes off this guy, and I don't have it. I have my own kind of weird serenity. I've had really, 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 really bad things happen to me sober. The worst was my soulmate. So I don't misconstrue anything, and it's not that I really care. I hate this, actually. But I'm a gay man. I hate the fact that I even have to say it. But the reality is, most of the world doesn't think that I deserve the same rights as straight people. So I still have to acknowledge that I'm something different, or it appears that I'm potentially hiding something that I'm not. Anyway. As a gay man, my closest soulmate was a woman in the fellowship. I love this woman. It was unbelievable. And anyway, she was sober 7 years, she had cancer a couple times. It spread to her bones. And she was absolutely sober, worked the hell out of the program, and still had to die of bone cancer in an incredibly painful death where, you know, at the avoiding morphine really till the end, but even then there's a point with bone cancer where it's just an overwhelming amount of pain, especially if, I think they've gotten better with the drugs, but a few years ago it just didn't really work. And and I had made a commitment to be with her for the last 2 months. You know, if she thought it was time, then I had said I would be there no matter what. And so I was there for 2 months, her last 2 months, and it was fucking horrid to see a human being sober 7 years, not being able to lie down. She had to sleep, and it wasn't sleep, you know, over a piece of metal because her back was so bent. You know, it was just almost criminal. it was a really bad thing to have happen in sobriety for me. But like everything, it took me somewhere, and I'm not saying I'm grateful that she got bone cancer, you know, but it definitely altered my spiritual pursuit in the program. And having to pray with somebody who didn't, you know, who's dying and is conscious and is smart and is sober and is afraid of dying, you know, what I'm trying to say is she stayed sober till the end. I stayed sober while she was dying. I stayed sober while I was intensely depressed after she died. And I guess you're going to hear it from somebody else about how to stay sober if you're happy. I'm here to talk about how to stay sober if you're having a tough time. Like, here's why I stay sober, even if I'm having a tough time. Because I look at alcoholics and I think they're fucking boring. Now, practicing alcoholics don't look interesting to me anymore. They look like CNN. The obsession to drink has been removed because I've worked the steps and because I got a great higher power. Oh, my higher power is all-inclusive, by the way. Like, my higher power is really great. Like, my higher power is every human being in the room. It's the poles that are holding the building up. It's the space between the people and the poles. It's incredibly big. It can't make any mistakes. It's an awesome higher power. I just forget about it all the time. You know, I forget that it's doing it the way it sees fit, and I want to tell it how it should do it, and I keep underestimating that this thing spins universes upon universes upon universes and keeps it all going really well. And I get mad about certain small, very small adjustments, all focused in because I'm playing God, you know, and thinking I know exactly. I'll skip to another thing. The old guy said, I met him in Amsterdam years ago, and then I went out to Australia to hang out with this man because I found him so mind-blowing. And so, you know, in AA, where we break down every line of the big book, lots of people do, and it was in the third step prayer. And I'd heard it for years, you know, that line. I love, take away my difficulties so that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. I think it's cool. And it works. All my defects, not all, but a lot of the ones that keep me from helping somebody have been removed. All my other defects are still here. All the ones that I wanted to get rid of, they've stuck around. You know, they suck. They're still around. But the ones for helping people, that prayer works. But this old man said the line, relieve me of the bondage of self. His definition of that was any time he thought he knew what he should be doing. That was his definition of the bondage of self. And he said this at a meeting in Holland almost 10 years ago. And then I thought I'd heard something really weird that night. And I spent the next 3 years thinking about that sentence, and I found out it's 100% true. That the only way I can have a problem with anything, I've found no exception, is if I think I know how things should be. If I let go of thinking I know how things should be, the problem disappears. It has to, because the only reason it's a problem is because I know how it should be. And it's not that way. You know? And so that's one of the reasons I've hung out with this guy quite a bit. And, yeah, I... Okay, How am I? I don't even know when I started or when I'm supposed to. 45 minutes and.
Close.
Okay, I'll limit. I'll wind it up in 5 minutes because you probably don't want to hear him ramble. I guess I should say. I love the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in them 100%. Right now, I'm working them really quick with newcomers, really fast. Just, I don't believe in dicking around anymore. I believe in the power of the steps, that they do something just incredible. Like, that it, there's four-step promises, you know, there's ninth-step promises, and they really do work. And if I can basically work, it's just, this is what I'm doing right now. I used to work the steps a lot slower with people, and I'd work them slow myself. But if I can get somebody to get through those first four, five, six, seven steps, in the first few months, it just seems their odds of sticking around are really high. Really, really high. So even if you spent, this is just my opinion again, even if it took you, as it did me, a couple years to work the steps, you can still work the steps really fast with somebody. I'm just saying that it tends to work. You know, those people that you work the steps pretty quickly with and you get them to, that second sponsor I had said he would not sponsor me unless I went to 4 meetings a week. He didn't suggest it. You know, he just didn't. And that was fair. That was really fair for him. Here's what he said. He said, if you're prescribing the meetings, and he was right, if I was doing badly, I'd go to 6 meetings. As soon as I was doing well, I'd go to 1. Right? Because I'd find my balance. You know, I'm doing good. What the hell? I don't need to waste my time here. You know, he said go to 4 a week. I don't know why. I'm an ornery person. But one thing in AA I've done is I follow some suggestions. It takes me a long time, as it does everybody I know around here, to do them. But I ended up, for 10 years, I went to 4 meetings a week. More than anything else, making that surrender. And I don't even think it's the 4 meetings a week. I think it's that I followed a suggestion. So it wasn't me prescribing me. It was following this guy's suggestion, but it worked. You know, I don't know what worked. I got a decent higher power. You know, I had the grace. I don't believe anybody who's drinking did it on purpose or made a mistake. Everybody's done the best they could. I got lucky. And I was able to follow that suggestion, but it's a powerful one to go to meetings really regular and work the steps. And in general, it works. You know, and I come here tonight, the last couple of days, and I've seen so many people who I was there when they came in the Dutch Fellowship 9 or 10 years ago. And let me tell you, the majority of them were moaning, complaining, life is rotten and it's never going to get better. I mean, they were all just like me. And now it's 9 or 10 years later and life has gotten better. You know, they still are moaning, complaining, but only to a degree. You know, like I still moan, I still complain, and I know for a fact it's not a difficulty that my higher power wants to remove, because if I honestly moan and complain, I can actually help people. Does that make any sense at all? When I tell honestly what my problems are, other alcoholics don't feel like they're doing something wrong when they have problems too, and they haven't emancipated to some phony Oprah Winfrey level of sobriety where they no longer, you know, experience difficulty. It's like, these are tough. I followed some suggestions. I have plenty that I can complain about, and I mentioned one really low point, my friend's bone cancer, which was really my lowest point in sobriety. But I have high points. I followed that, the guy who had me do the third step prayer was a telemarketer. I was a punk rock musician. He was a salesman. He rode his bike named Spirit. I'd run into him on the beach coming home. He'd be getting up. We were total opposites. When I was a year or two sober, he told me to quit my job and only do music. He believed in me. I was too fearful to do that. It took a while, but I ended up doing it. I've only done music ever since. When I was 5 or 6 years sober, he told me, I said I had an opportunity in Europe. I was too scared to do it. I had no money. I had $400. He said, go to Europe, you'll be taken care of. It's I've been outside of America now for 12 or 13 years. I've been incredibly well taken care of. I get to travel. I go where I want to be for 6 months at a time. I've been doing it for whatever, 11, 12 years now. It's magic. I spend a lot of time in Australia. I love my life. It's all from following other people's directions, and it's totally clear that that's what it's from, because I'm too afraid to do these big moves on my own. I needed their confidence and to do that. And I mean, here's the thing. I have my complaints about Alcoholics Anonymous. I just think it's better than anything else on earth. But it has weaknesses. You know, the main weakness is it's made of human beings. You know, we're screwed units. We're all missing a little thing. We're all control freaks. We're all, you know, selfish. We all talk too long. We judge people harsher than we judge ourselves, condemn. We do all these weird things. But the thing about AA is it's free. It's not a business venture. It connects me with people that I wouldn't normally be connected to, and I love them. It took me to Holland, you know, and I love this country. I just think it's a fucking great place, and when I first got here, I would, like a good American, I would, and it was just a civil tree or whatever, I would say, "How are you?" And I cannot tell you the number of times Dutch people came up to me back then and said, "Do you really care?" Yeah. You know? And it's like, and I learned to care about what I said to somebody and that it fucking matters. And anyway, you know, I'm just so grateful to be asked. If you knew Kathy, who's chairing this convention 7 years ago, you would know what a miracle this thing is. It's like, if you knew me, look, these guys could tell you. Let me tell you one thing, and this will be the last thing. 8 or 9 years ago, Keith wanted me to tell you all, he's my higher power, stand up. No, if you knew even Keith. But 9 or 10 years ago, I had 16 colors of dreadlocks, jet black hair like this. You know, things, and that was sober at that time, quite a few years, you know. It's like people change, and actually I think I may have been healthier then, you know. Like, I love AA. I'm so grateful to have been here and grateful to be in Holland, and God, it's a good gig. I just hope we continue to give for free, and I hope that we continue to care for people and be creative in how we learn to give to somebody, and to remember that they automatically deserve, and to remember that Bill Wilson went out and looked for alcoholics who he could give it to. They didn't need to come and ask. I guess that's it.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.